ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Thanks so much for listening to the 49th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I have a really great interview with Greg Hurwitz, who has recently completed the Penguin Pain and Prejudice miniseries and is taking on the writing chores in Batman The Dark Knight, working with David Finch. I have to apologize in advance. My throat kind of gave out at times during the interview, but Greg sounds good anyway, so be sure to listen to him. After that, I review this week's comics. Then we wrap things up with Ian Cullen and Gianluca Glazer joining me for this week's news and previews. I think you're going to really enjoy the interview, so let's get on with the show. Welcome to the podcast today, the accomplished author of best-selling novels like The Crime Writer, The Kill Clause, The Program, and You're Next, as well as the great comics including Penguin, Pain, and Prejudice for DC. How are you doing today, Greg?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. I want to congratulate you, first thing, on being selected to write Batman The Dark Knight. I think that's a great accomplishment.
Thank you very much. It's definitely a cool gig.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it tremendously. Now, first thing I want to talk about, of course, is Penguin, Pain, and Prejudice. I'm a big Batman fan, so I loved that miniseries. And I see it's been called the best miniseries of 2011. I have to say, it's like The Dark Knight. This is the first time I was actually scared of Joker in the Dark Knight movie. This time I was scared of the Penguin for the first time. Now, he's been sort of a goofy character in the past, but you actually built him into something that not only was I scared of, but I was sympathetic towards. So,
thank you. I mean, it was funny. It was a bit of a tall order. When we first announced that I was doing the Penguin mini, a lot of people have their Burgess Meredith hesitations, you know, and there was a good amount of skepticism, but I had just a really clear take in my head of how I wanted to proceed, and I wanted to paint him in some of the shades of gray so that it could also illuminate more things about Batman. And at the same time, I wanted to make him a legitimate menace instead of just somebody who's flinging around umbrellas. And so it was part of the thing that I wanted to do in terms of updating him and having the New 52 approach to who's a classic and really fun villain. I mean, Penguin's always been fun. I just don't know that he's always been frightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to agree. I don't think he's always been frightening.
Though. I mean, he's always been one of my favorite characters.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just curious as to how did you get involved with it? Because the New 52 obviously was coming, and this is not necessarily a part of the New 52, but it timed to come out right when the New 52 was beginning. Can you explain a little bit how that took place?
Yeah, well, I had a meeting with Dan Didio, and I talked him through. It was sort of one of those open conversations about if I would do some work for DC, what would I most want to do? And I had this really clear story in my head with the Penguin. And so I kind of trotted it out, and we weren't sure what the format was. But because I do novels and film and TV and other stuff, sometimes it's tougher for me to commit to an ongoing. And so we decided that the best format would be to do a miniseries where I can really explore the Penguin. We can bring it out. It fits with what DC was trying to do, which is have a new take and have these exciting updates on these great classic characters. And this was a chance to pick one and really plumb the depths of it and also be able to do it in a way that worked with my schedule and my other commitments. And so that's why we agreed on a miniseries format.
It's interesting because I thought that the art complemented your story so well, very dark and very moody. And the thing I kept saying over and over again when I was reading this book, I kept telling people, they need these people on other Batman books. They're doing such a great job of this. And
I think Ziman's work is jaw-dropping. I mean, I love it. I love the job he did. And from page one, he was spectacular. I mean, I love the moodiness. I love how sometimes he'll go to kind of a photorealist angle. Mm-hmm. I love how he complements this darkness of the Penguin. The panels get darker and darker as it progresses. I mean, I just think he's an incredible talent, and he's a superstar.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly works so well. I just love the whole put together of how it was. I couldn't wait for the next issue to come out.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was just terrific. Now, you once said that you like to write about good people who find themselves in extraordinary situations. The Penguin, I think, is a little different from that, isn't he? He's not necessarily a good person.
No, he's not. I think, you know, I said that in reference to my book, my last couple books. You're Next and They're Watching are sort of the classic everyman Hitchcock characters where you find somebody who's ordinary, just like you or me, but you meet them on the worst day of their life. And I try to really amp up the pressure on them. And a lot of the inspiration on the novel side for me comes from those great Hitchcock movies, Rear Window, North by Northwest, where somebody winds up in the middle of a plot. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you have in comics is there's already built-in motive because you're inheriting these characters. And so it's a little bit different in the setup. It's like the Penguin already runs a criminal empire, but I still wanted to reach back and show some of the influences that he may have felt in a way that set him on this course and that set him on this path. And in an odd way, I believe that when you make somebody more human and when you dimensionalize them, it actually makes them more scary than if they're just cackling and evil because they were born evil. It's less relatable. And so part of my aim was if I could show some of the humanity behind him and then show him still overriding that and doing things that are incredibly cruel, but we sort of can relate to that, that for me is a more compelling and unnerving dimension of a character.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I thought that humanized the Penguin was the blind woman and his relationship to her. And when we get to the fifth issue, when for the first time she finally gets to touch his face, her reaction really surprised me. And I don't want to spoil it because I'm hoping this will be collected into a hardcover or a trade and people get to read it. But I thought her character really did humanize him in the sense that she saw, like, you know, blind people touching elephants. She touched the part of the elephant that he wasn't used to people actually seeing. And I thought that made him sympathetic in a lot of ways. On the other hand, you've got him going and doing really nasty things to people. I mean, you know, killing people's families and besmirching their reputations. So you've got this really interesting dichotomy in the character. And by the end of it, I really felt for him. When he has to take on Batman physically, I felt sorry for him because I know he can't possibly win.
Yeah. Well, not a lot of people are going to win that one. But, you know, with Cassandra, part of the aim there was, in a way, it's perfect if somebody's blind and Oswald has this incredibly guarded, defensive, underlying simmering rage at the rejection he's felt in the world. And it's one of the reasons why he wields his power so with such comprehensive authority. And part of my thinking was if somebody was blind, she wouldn't have a template the same way that other people do for appearance, you know, in terms of determining who's attractive, who isn't. And what she could witness with her other senses as he moves about when they're out in public, when they're in private, is that he has a certain kind of confidence because the power can masquerade for that. So she says to him, I can tell how people react to you. I can tell when you're out in the world, you must be an important, powerful, handsome guy because of the way the world clears out of his way and the impact he can have on it. And so her perception of him being blind, she doesn't bring with it all the prejudices that he's endured at the hands of his family, in school, his childhood. And so she's able to see past that, ironically, by dint of being blind, you know, until that scene in the end where she finally touches him and realizes what he looks like, and her reaction probably is certainly not one that he expected. I think it's one that readers don't expect either.
That's exactly what I felt. I was so surprised, and the look on the Penguin's face when he realizes her reaction is not what he expects, I thought that was a great moment. Another thing I thought about the Penguin that amazed me was that he wouldn't allow himself to be touched, which in a sense was a real sympathetic thing. Did you go in planning that? Did you want the Penguin to be someone who was sort of aloof as a character?
Well, it's less for me about the aloofness, and it's more that if she touches him, she's going to know him, and she'll know what he looks like. And he's in fear because she's blind. He's incredibly attracted to her. He's got a lot of emotions toward her that make him uncomfortable. And basically, he doesn't want her to touch him and figure out his height, his face, and his features. He wants to perpetuate her fantasy, mythologized version of him because he believes that in reality he's not going to measure up. So he's got that intense reaction to it. And for me, a lot of what I derived and brought to his character in school, my graduate degree, because I needed a very helpful degree to enter the job force, was in Shakespearean tragedy. And so one of the things that I think a lot about when I'm approaching a character is how can something that is their strongest trait also lead to their downfall? How can that also be the tragic flaw? For him, I think it's the cause of his undoing in the primary plot with Batman, and it also plays a really key role in his shot of happiness with Cassandra.
Mm-hmm. Now, you end the miniseries on a note where we could see more of the Penguin. Do you have plans to possibly bring him back, maybe in even the Dark Knight book?
He might make an appearance.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that.
Hide, you know?
Yeah. Now, moving into Batman the Dark Knight, I read that you're planning on doing some of the same things you did for the Penguin to the Scarecrow.
Yes.
And I've always felt the Scarecrow was another one-note villain, and what you've done with the Penguin encourages me as far as what you're going to do with the Scarecrow. I'd be very fascinated to see that.
Oh, well, good. I'm really excited. And it's funny because when we announced it, like I said, with the Penguin, there was a good amount of skepticism. And it's nice that I think I've earned some trust with people going in handling Scarecrow 2 in terms of us trying to do something that I've talked to Finch a lot about what the game plan is. And we want to do something that's a new take that involves a more in-depth examination, a clearer orientation toward what the motives are of the Scarecrow. And he's been a character like Penguin who's always fascinated me. I want to be really clear to not denigrate any of the prior depictions of these characters, because Scarecrow and Penguin are probably my two favorite villains in the Rogues Gallery. I love them. And so it's not about taking something that I think is broken and fixing it. It's really about taking something and trying to figure out what's a very contemporary, real, and new take on these characters that reimagines them for 2012. Mm-hmm. And Scarecrow, for me, I've always loved his emphasis on psychology and fear, because I think it's the flip side of what drives Batman. I mean, Batman is driven by fear and loss, and I think there's a way that those two fit together into the yin-yang that's similar to the very unique relationship that he has with the Penguin, where in a lot of ways they're sort of polar opposite. And there's a scene in Penguin where he's brushing his teeth and he pictures himself as taller and broader and more built. I mean, like, he sort of pictures the Batman version of himself almost, because they're so opposite. And with Scarecrow, I think there's something else going on. In some ways, he's almost more like Batman than his opposite. He's more of a mirror than a foil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to that greatly. I just want to let you know, too, that when I started reading Penguin, I had read your other comics, but I hadn't read your novels. And as I got into Penguin more and more, I went back and I've actually bought the audiobooks for many of your novels.
Oh,
so
great.
This morning, when I had to go to the bank before I came and did to talk with you, I was listening to The Crime Writer, which I'm into. It almost sounds a little autobiographical.
It is. The house in The Crime Writer is actually my house.
Ah.
So the view when he goes out on the deck and takes that look out across Los Angeles, that's my deck. So it's funny when I have people come over to the house, they'll come and go on the back deck and go, wait a minute, like, this looks familiar. But I'd say that if people are digging in and taking a look at the books, my last one, Your Next, that came out some months ago, has a couple hidden references and jokes about comics and about graphic novels that I think people will enjoy. So it's kind of fun to build that into that one.
I bought that, so I'm looking forward to getting to that. But I want to go. I'm going sequentially, though, so I want to get them all that way.
Crime Writer is a good place to start, and then when you get to Your Next, there's a couple comics that he's reading that I don't identify, but I only identify in ways that comic readers are going to know what he's reading. Whereas if people just read novels, they're not going to have any clue. So that was kind of fun.
Okay. Well, the last thing I wanted to do is make a suggestion, if I can.
All right.
You're a mystery writer, and Batman's been called the world's greatest detective, but in the comics, he very rarely does any mystery solving. It's mostly him as an adventurer. I realize you're not writing detective comics, you're writing The Dark Knight, but is there any chance that you might actually have him solve a mystery or two in the comic as you go forward?
I mean, it's certainly not ruling it out. For me, the investigative capacity is something that sets him apart. Like you said, I'm not writing tech. That's being handled very, very well by another crew. But for me, one of the things that I want to deliver in The Dark Knight and to take advantage of is, I mean, I think Finch is unparalleled at doing the sort of big sweeping action with the big splash pages. And I want to have a real emphasis on character and on creating a broad, epic, sweeping plot. And so there are going to be investigative elements. That's really important. But it's not going to be a boiled-down procedural, because we want to create something that's very vast in scope. And so I want to play with those elements, and I do have some of those that I bring in from the novel side, but I also want to make sure that we're having a lot of fun painting on a bigger canvas as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, I wish you much success. I can't wait for Batman the Dark Knight to get started.
Thank you very much.
Do you know which issue it is that you start writing?
I think it's number 10.
Number 10, okay. Well, I'm looking forward to that greatly, and can't wait.
Well,
so
thank you.
Thanks so much for contributing to my favorite character in comics.
Oh, you know, it's my pleasure. It's sort of a dream job, so it's nothing that I need to be thanked for.
Well, I appreciate spending my money and giving that to get to you if I'm going to get such great stories. So
excellent. Okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure. We'll see you somewhere else.
Oh, I'm sure. I'll go to cons regularly. I'll try to catch up with you sometime.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Take care.
Gather gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe. Here in this great hall of justice are the most powerful forces of good ever assembled.
It's Wayne's Comic Review.
Dedicated to truth, justice, and peace for all mankind.
Let's have a look at the latest comics. It seems more and more that comics want to explore the dark side of humanity. Recently, I talked about The Cape by Joe Hill, which did that very well. This week, it's time for The Manhattan Projects, number one, which is written by Jonathan Hickman, who recently left Fantastic Four and FF. It's a really interesting book and has this description. What if the research and development created to produce the first atomic bomb was a front for a series of other more unusual programs? What if the union of a generation's brightest minds was not a signal for optimism, but foreboding? What if everything went wrong? And the book is subtitled Infinite Oppenheimers. If you read it, you'll understand why they do that. There's a lot of interesting things going on. We meet Robert's twin, Joseph, and he's not very much like his brother. He's very much into a psychopathic way of living. He enjoys killing. We learn that Joseph actually has this notion if he eats an animal, its soul will live on inside of him. That leads to some very interesting things and a big surprise at the end of the comic. It's a very unusual book. It's one of the good things that's coming out from Image. I would encourage you to read that. As far as the New 52 goes, Detective Comics once again does a great job of showcasing Tony Daniels' writing and art. Action Comics number 7 shows us how Superman received his new costume. Animal Man gives Buddy a glimpse into the future, while Swamp Thing brings Alec Colin full circle, and we actually get to see the Swamp Thing for the first time in 7 issues. Then I liked Batwing, which has the entire Bat family involved. In Justice League International number 7, everything goes to hell in a handbasket for the team. Red Lantern sees the human Red Lantern squaring off against Guy Gardner. Hawk and Dove is now both written and drawn by Rob Liefeld. Stormwatch, the first part of a story written by Paul Jenkins. In the latest Green Arrow, Anne Nesenti takes over the writing reins and pits him against Triplet Girls. Next, I enjoyed Men of War, which had a very touching backup story by J.T. Krull, who was on this podcast last week. Olmec is rushing towards the last issue next month, and Static Shock also has the teen hero taking on FaZe, something of an opposite number for him. Other books that are worth getting are DC Universe Online Legends number 25, Night Force number 1 of 7, Huntress number 6 of 6, and Supernatural number 6 of 6 from DC. There's Peanuts, Happiness is a Warm Blanket, Charlie Brown, Superbia number 1, Valen the Outcast number 4, and Irredeemable number 35 from Boom Studios. Marvel's put out Toy Story number 1 of 4 and Venom number 14. Another Image book worth getting is Fatale number 3. Great book. Really weird stuff going on in that book. IDW has True Blood, The French Quarter, number 6 of 6. Lots of 6 of 6s this week. And Dream Reavers, number 4 of 4 from Ape Comics is out. Sorry that's coming to an end, but boy, it's hard to get a hold of. Still worth getting. I really liked it. And those are the books that came out this week.
If you're looking for serious science fiction, well, we can't really help you. But if you're looking for science fiction with fun, join us at sfp-now.com.
If you absolutely insist on using erotic persuasion to achieve your devious ends, then so be it.
Okay, it's time for this week's news and previews, and with me this week, as always, is Ian Cullen. How are you, Ian?
I'm good.
And happy birthday to Gianluca Glazer. How are you, Gianluca?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much, guys.
Okay, and let's get into the news and previews. The news part, I wanted to talk a little bit about the February numbers that came out. We finally got February, about a week into March, which is a little late. Gianluca, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of an interesting thing where the top 10 was dominated by DC. They took all the top 10 spots. But the actual market share, units and dollars sold, goes to Marvel for the month of February. Especially alarming is the dollar amount, basically. For the dollar, DC had 29.47%, and Marvel had 35.92%. So it's not very close. It's actually over 6% difference, or almost 6% difference. So that is kind of interesting. For unit shares, it's a little bit closer. DC had 35.26%. Marvel had 38.61%. Other interesting things I noticed offhand, IDW was number 3. They were the last company to join Diamond's premier section. So they edged out Image Comics and Dark Horse Comics to take the number 3 spot. And number 4 was Image Comics. Everything else was kind of the same. And doing kind of a comparison, everything's kind of been up from last month and last year. Comparing to January, the month prior, comics were up 10.84% in dollars and 8.36% in units. Graphic novels were both up just over 11% in both units and dollars. In comparison to last year, not a big surprise to find that comics were up 22.26% in dollars and 19.63% in units. Considering that probably comics were like at an all-time low a year ago, and the new 52 reinvigorated things, and now you have Marvel coming up with their big event with Avengers and X-Men. So.
Do you think also the economic climate could be in some ways helping? Because the one thing that's never really suffered through the economic climate, even during the Depression, is comic books. They've always seemed to thrive in those sort of conditions, and I'm just wondering if there might have been a little bit of spike in sales because of that as well. People being laid off, maybe having a little bit more time to spend and...
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, a lot of people have been laid off in 2011. Things were pretty bad. If anything, the market maybe, things may be economically getting a little bit better in February. But I really do think the new 52 really had a lot to do with comic sales being up. The other thing, too, is the reason why Marvel is ahead in terms of the market, units and dollars, is because they're producing more content. And this changes the equation, too, from a year ago in comparing comic sales last year to this year, is that Marvel's putting out twice a month issues of books, the same titles. They're also producing more books. Even though they've kind of cut things down a bit, they've canceled some titles, they're still producing more, much more than DC. And this has to worry DC, because coming this summer, you're going to have the big crossover event with Marvel, which Marvel already has initial orders of over 200,000, and it's probably going to be the number one spot for that particular month it comes out. That should scare DC, because the new 52 is kind of stabilizing, and as we'll talk about a little later, the changes have been going on creatively, and kind of a bit of a panic, it seems like, sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't bode well. DC needs another new shake-up thing for this year, because Image is shaking things up, Marvel is shaking things up, and you have new publishers like Valiant that are coming back and shaking things up.
So basically what DC need to do is they need to, around about August of this year, they need to do the 104.
Right.
It's interesting because Marvel continues to sell most of their comics at $3.99, so I'm not surprised that they're actually making more money than DC is. DC's trying to keep at $2.99, and that's going to put them a little bit behind what Marvel's doing. But yeah, as far as like when Avengers versus X-Men, it's not that far off. The first issue is going to appear in about a month, and DC's got to be nervous about that. Although you never know. I mean, the truth of it is that Marvel, in some levels, benefited from the new 52 because some people who came back to comics picked up Marvel as well. So maybe what'll happen is if some people go in to buy all the Marvels, some of them will go in and say, well, I never did get a chance to see what the new 52 stuff was about and start to pick that up. The notion that the water raises all boats kind of stuff. We'll see how that goes going into it, but people are calling the Avengers versus X-Men the reaction to the new 52, Marvel's attempt to regain the spotlight. And I think they're probably pretty right. I got a big kick I do have to mention and related was that Joe Quesada finally came out and said something about that. He referred to the new 52 as DC burning down the building in order to try to reinvigorate the line. But the truth of the matter is that it worked extremely successfully. And going forward, I still hope that DC is going to be able, with the second wave of the new 52, to be able to do like Marvel did, is to get rid of some of the lower selling titles and maybe make their numbers go up as a whole. I mean, we'll see. I think the Batman Inc., I think, is a good choice. Otherwise, I'm still not convinced that there's a place for a war comic, but we'll see.
Right.
We'll see about that. But anything else we should say about this?
I think very, very quickly, you've got the Avengers Assemble coming out here in the UK on the 26th of April, and it also comes out, I think it's, in May for you guys? That's not going to hinder Marvel's comic sales either. You know, I should imagine when that comes out, you probably get people going into the comic stores looking for various trade paperbacks of Avengers who've never read an Avengers comic before. You know, so that's not going to hinder Marvel sales figures.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I guess in another month or so, we'll get another sense how things are going. When I talked to Pete Casazza from Big Planet Comics, he expected that the very first Avengers vs. X-Men was going to be their top seller of the month when it shows up. Now, I did want to mention one other related thing, was that Justice League number one has crossed the 400,000 mark in prints. It was at 300,000 before, now it's at 400,000. So it's an interesting thing to see how this is going. The hardcovers and the trades are going to start coming out before long from the early New 52. So we'll see how that goes. Why don't we move on to something else? Gianluca, you got other news you want to talk about?
Absolutely. In June, Marvel is going to include a digital copy with all of their $3.99 books. That was recently announced. Last week, I talked to you guys a little bit about Valiant and how they have four titles coming out in the summer. Well, the four titles have finally been fully revealed. So in May, they have Exo Manowar number one with New York Times bestselling author Robert Venditti, who did The Surrogates and the Homeland Directive.
That's the film that I was trying to think of last week when you talked about that, was The Surrogates, because they made a movie of it with Bruce Willis.
Ah, cool.
I read that book, and we actually did interview Robert Venditti.
Oh, cool.
A number of years back.
I like the comics.
Yeah, definitely bring them back to talk about this new title. And the artwork on that's going to be by Eisner Award-winning artist Carrie Nord, who did Conan. The next month in June, they have Harbinger number one from another New York Times best-selling author, Joshua Dysart, for Unknown Soldier and BPRD. And Harvey Award nominee Kari Evans, who did Carbon Gray. July has Bloodshot number one, which I told you guys last week it was going to become also. There's some movie deal going on with that. Dwayne Zersinski, who did the Immortal Iron Fist and Birds of Prey, is writing that. And the artist for that is going to be Manuel Garcia, who worked on Spider-Man Breakout. And Arturo Lozzi, there you go, who did a book of Mortal Weapons. August, and then finally August, you have Archer and Armstrong number one. That was the last title that we didn't know it was going to be, so that's been announced. It's going to be written by Fred Van Lent, who did Amazing Spider-Man and Hulk Season 1. Artwork by Clayton Henry, who worked on Uncanny X-Men. So, some big heavy hitters there attached to the titles.
The thing about Harbinger that I really liked was that there was a group of teens with powers, but they were genuinely a much more diverse group than we're used to seeing. Usually they're like teen models. There was actually a character in Harbinger, and I don't know whether she's going to come back or not, but she was a very, shall we say, plump girl who could fly, which was really something different. I really liked the fact that she was very unlike any other girl teen that we've seen. Usually girl teens are either nerds or they're the hot babe kind of characters. She was neither, and she was a really interesting character, and I hope that they bring her back because she was something different. I've always been fascinated to see a heavy set character who could fly. It kind of goes against the grain, but I like that.
Basically, she ate a lot of beef burgers and hamburgers in order to help her fly.
I don't know that being overweight helped her fly. I think that was, she did that in spite of her being overweight. I think the notion was presented that if she lost some weight, she'd be actually better at flying. So they started that before the book stopped. But I just thought that was something very different. You know, I'm drawn to things that are different in comics. And her character was something very unusual in comics. So I like that. Anyway, other news?
Yeah, there is a few things. I did want to mention, though, with Valiant, though. I mean, it does seem that they do have a lot of money to throw around. They definitely hired some big-time creators to work on their books. I'm just kind of curious to see how this is going to play out. They are going to be competing against Marvel's big event. Will retailers buy into all of these titles and go heavy on ordering them? How is it going to be long-term with these guys? Are they going to be keeping these same people on board for a number of issues? It's kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see how things work out with this.
Mm-hmm.
In a bit of sucky news, Amy Reeder is leading Batwoman. It really stinks. She was, seven comes out next week. But they're going to have Trevor McCarthy, who did Batman Gates of Gotham, to draw issues 9 through 11 before J.H. Williams III returns to do art duties for his story arc. So, no particular reason given. I guess creative differences is to blame. I'm really kind of sad to see that the kind of change that they did make, though. I thought Amy complimented J.H. Williams' style very well, But Trevor McCarthy, from reading Gates of Gotham, his style is totally different. I just don't see how this is going to mesh or keep the book looking as good as it has. Mm-hmm. If I had my choice, I would have, even though he's working on Animal Man, I would have had Steve Pugh. He has a very similar style to J.H. Holmes III, and you could have had the same color as Dave Stewart do the colors for him, make it fit. I think it would have been good. Mm-hmm. In other DC news, other artists, change-up news, Tony S. Daniel is just taking a three-issue comic break from Detective Comics. He's still writing it, but for the artwork, it's going to be done by Ed Baines for issues number 10 through 12, and then Tony comes back on board. And final news before Ian gives his thing, Marvel is teasing a Spider-Man book, another big event that they're doing over the summer, in June particularly, with Brian Michael Bendis writing, Sarah Fischelli doing the artwork, and the cover by Jim Chung. And I guess this is going to unite Peter Parker with Miles Morales, the two Spider-Men meeting up.
Let me ask you guys before we get to Ian, what was your reaction to Spider Island, the event?
Oh, I didn't really care for it, but obviously it made a lot of money and did very well on the charts, but it baffles me.
It was kind of a non-event for me because I didn't even bother with it.
See, this is the thing about Marvel events that always gets me. There's always a big, whoa, Marvel event. And when it's over with, everybody goes, there's always a big before saying this is going to be just the best thing that's ever been. And then all of a sudden when it's over with, people go, well, that wasn't really the best thing that's ever been. And, you know, the Spider Island thing to me was a big bust. People I know who bought Spider-Man kind of went, well, it was there. I hate to say this, but it's and it reveals my bias, I guess, is that a lot of the times that the Marvel events, the buzz is so big, and then the depressurization that happens after it is so strong that it's just a fascinating thing to watch. That's why I'm kind of thinking, as soon as you said Spider-Man, I thought, oh, here we go again. We're going to have another big thing that Marvel's going to push the daylights out of. The New York Times might write a big article about it, and then once it's over, everyone's going to say, oh, I'm glad that's over with.
And another big shocker, another death in comic books last less than a year. You know what? I remember, you know, Sesame Street when Mr. Hooper died. Episode, you know, paying tribute to the man and having to explain to Big Bird what death really means, that it doesn't mean coming back. Maybe someone in the comic book industry should show this video.
Okay, Ian, how about you? You've got two stories.
Well, I'll just go with the one, just to cut it short. This is a bit of sad news, really. Jean Mobius, Girard?
Girard.
He sadly passed away. He was suffering from a long-term illness. And, you know, the French artist passed away at the age of 73 in Paris. His influential style in art and storytelling has had a major influence on every major form of illustration. He used the alias Mobius during the 1960s when he began his foray into imaginative subject matter, and he stopped using that name when he became one of the co-founders of Mattel Herlant in 1975. He actually worked on two issues of The Silver Surfer for a story by Stan Lee, and Hollywood was also very impressed with Girard's work because he went on to design storyboards for movies such as Alien, Tron, and The Abyss. That's a really, really great loss to the comics and the field of visual arts in general, really.
Yeah, he's dropping like flies these days. We've lost several, even only in the first few months of 2012.
Bill Simon, right at the beginning of the year. That was kind of a sad one because I'd been reading his autobiography, which was written by him, and I was thinking, whoa, he's 98. I was thinking, cool, this guy's 98. He's probably going to live to 100. And no, sadly, I jinxed that.
You cursed him. I'm kidding.
I jinxed it.
You jinxed it.
Yeah.
Good job, Ian. You killed...
I killed Joe Simon, man.
You killed Joe Simon. Oh, man. You didn't have anything to do with Mobius, did you, before
Seriously,
he passed?
Seriously, stay away from Wikipedia.
Yeah, stay away.
I'm glad you don't like Jeff Johns or Jim Lee or stuff.
Why don't we hook him on J. Michael Straczynski?
Yeah. No, that would never work, because I want
Ian
that.
Predict
no,
how
no,
he's going to live, too.
How old is he now?
Too old.
He's like, what, about 200 now?
He may as well be.
It takes about 200 years to get through a story, I mean, basically.
Yes. Well, there is that. Yes, yes. Okay. Gianluca, let's get back to you. Let's talk about the stuff that you're looking forward to this
week. Going on sale March 14th. Lots of good stuff this particular week. Batwoman number 7 comes out with Amy Reeder. Please support her. She's only got 2 more issues left. Over on Image, a lot of good stuff. Marksman number 6, the final chapter from this really...
Yay! Boy, am I looking forward to that.
David Baxter, Gary Leach, Javier Aranda.
Can I do my voice now? Look out!
Sure.
Coming from Image Comics, Marksman.
There you go. That fits very well. Moriarty Volume 2 trade paperback goes on sale. This is the second and final, for now at least, chapter of Moriarty from Daniel Corey and Anthony Desidu. Blue Estate number 10. There's only 3 more issues after that. So definitely, or it goes to issue 12. So definitely check that out. Maybe catch up if you haven't read it before. Otherwise, you might be confused. And then the big one that Image is probably going to promote the hell out of, the Saga from number 1 from Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, which is kind of an interesting story about a very strange-looking couple looking to raise a child while war is raging on, you know, on their planet, planetary war. Other interesting things from other publishers, Blue Water has a bio on the Three Stooges. Probably going to be really shitty in terms of art. Oops. But I like the Three Stooges, so I may flip through it, and if it looks decent enough, I'll pick it up. Boom Studios is Adventure Time number 2, and the first issue of that book was heavily underordered by retailers. They quickly found out there is a big demand for it. Wayne mentioned that second printing was out recently, and then they have a third printing coming out for issue number 1. Well, but the second issue, based off of the Cartoon Network show that everyone seems to love. You also have Exile on the Planet of the Apes number 1 from Boom as well.
Yeah, baby.
Other things that kind of interestingly popped out at me, Buckaroo Banzai number 1 comes out from Moonstone. I like the movie. It's based off of some popular books, so I might see if that's any good.
That was Peter Weller, wasn't it, Buckaroo Banzai?
Peter Weller, that is correct, yes, RoboCop. And
is that from Blue Water?
No, it's from Moonstone.
Ah, oh, okay. So,
similar to Blue Water.
Yeah, that's kind of shitty.
yeah, and Oni Press has The Secret History of D.B. Cooper number 1, a new series.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
And they have a J.H. Williams III variant cover. I remember when that was announced, so this book is finally out. Definitely going to check it out. And Arcana Comics has a graphic novel called Sideshows. It's written by Eric Hendricks, who does the marketing for the company, and a different Michael Nelson, not Michael Allen Nelson, but a different Mike Nelson does the artwork for it. And it involves mobsters and circus sideshow guys. So it's an interesting concept. The art looks good. Again, if I have any money left over, then I'll definitely be picking this one up.
Gianluca, for that one, the art isn't kind of shitty.
No, the art's actually pretty cool. And the cover is really, you know, badass looking as well, too. So.
Very cool. Yeah. For the upcoming releases, you mean?
Yeah, March 14th.
Mm-hmm. Exile on the Planet of the Apes, I'm really looking forward to. Can't wait to get my mitts on that. I love Karina Becko and Gabriel Hardman's first miniseries, which was Betrayal on the Planet of the Apes. And this is I've actually heard a little bit about this because they actually previewed it a little bit in the interview that we're going to be running next on the show. So I'm quite excited about that. Demon Knights, I'm really excited about. I think it's the 8th or 7th issue of Paul Cornell's Demon Knights. I'm quite really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've got Jeff Lemire's Frankenstein Agent of Shade coming out this month as well. So I'm really looking forward to that as well.
Are you going to stick with that when he reads the book?
We'll see how it goes. If it suddenly goes a little wibbly-wobbly, I'll stop reading it. But Grant Morrison is supposed to be one of the best writers on God's Green Earth. And I'm really hating what he's doing with the Action Comics right now, so I'm not into it at all. There's an interesting comic book here that I can see, and it's by George Perez or something. Oh, no, I think it's a book about George Perez's art that's due out this week. That looks quite interesting. It's got quite a kick-ass cover, very pulpy sort of cover. I think it's The Art of George Perez. It's got a very kick-ass, pulpy sort of like action cover that puts you in mind of 30s Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers cartoons. funny. Two women on the cover holding phases and a spaceship coming around a moon or something like that. IDW's got G.I. Joe Infestation coming out this week. The only reason I mentioned that is because I've got a visual cue on here and the cover looks pretty neat. And you've got a Doctor Who thing coming out this week through IDW. It's got a picture of Amy Pond on the cover. Mm-hmm. That's about it for me, really.
Okay, let me go ahead and run on through a couple of mine. Dark Matter number 3 of 4 is out. Of course, that's the book from Dark Horse that's created by some of the folks from the Stargate universe, which I really like. Batgirl number 7 continues on. There's an interesting book that the artist does not want you to buy that's coming out this week called Batman Year One, the Deluxe Edition Hardcover for about $25. Mr. Mazzucchelli, who did a wonderful job on the artwork, has come out and said that he doesn't like the reproduction and some of the things that they've added into this version of it. He says to go back and find the one that he was involved with 5-6 years ago rather than buy this one, which of course makes me all the more interested to take a look at it. Well, what's so bad about this one? Batman Year One Deluxe Hardcover for about $25.
I heard it took really bad files that were the artwork. I believe they're kind of blurry.
Yeah. He says that the reproduction is not all that good, so... And it's probably going to be something... But I just have to look. When somebody says don't do it, it's my nature. I got to go and look at it. I do too, thankfully. I love that. And of course, they just did a video, direct-to-DVD animated
I really enjoyed that Batman Year One animation. It was fantastic. Just loved it.
Great. Great.
Seen Justice League Doom.
They're all good. Oh, it's very good. It's based on Mark Waid's story of when Batman has decided, it's all in the publicity. So I'm not giving away anything when you say that Batman worries that at some point if the Justice League goes bad or goes rogue, how would he stop them? And what he's done is he's developed ways to defeat every Justice League member because he's got intimate knowledge of them, working with them, as to what's going to happen with it. And Vandal Savage, in the very beginning, accesses that information and sends the villains that have to do with these heroes after those characters. And Claudia Black does a wonderful voice of the Cheetah. She does a great job of that. I really like that real well. So there's a lot of really good voice. It's a very good comic book related thing. I really like the action. Lots and lots of action. There's more going on than this, of course. Vandal Savage is involved. In the comics, Ra's al Ghul was the one who got all this information, but it's Vandal Savage in here. They're going a different route. And it's a good movie. The animation is much like about a year ago when they came out with Justice League Crisis on Tour. Batman looks very much like it. The selling point for this movie, of course, is that the voices of all the original characters, except for Nathan Fillion, who comes in Green Lantern. All the other ones who are the voices have been doing the voices in Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. So it's very good. The voices are great. It's just a great story. I enjoyed very much watching it. They do a nice couple of twists hither and yither. And I don't think Nathan Fillion does the countrified Hal Jordan voice that I've heard him do in the past. Much more him. And I like that a lot. So that was really good. I like that a lot. Anyway, a couple of other things that I think deserve mentioning. I agree with you, Marksman. I can't wait to see how that ends. Oh, what a great book. What a great book. Thief of Thieves number 2 by Nick Spencer and Robert Kirkman is coming out. I like that one. They're also putting a second printing of issue number 1, so you'll be able to catch up if you hadn't before. Comeback Kings number 2 is coming out. And that must be like an annual. I mean, Comeback Kings, this is also from...
It's from Arden Entertainment, that one. It's not from Atlas, it's Arden Entertainment.
Yes. Yeah, Brendan Dineen's involved with it. It's all about people who supposedly have died, and actually they haven't, and they're banding together to fight evil, including like Bruce Lee and Elvis and all other kinds of things. It's a really different book. I enjoyed it quite a lot, so it's a very good book. Another book that definitely worth talking about, this is the book that should be bought and it just never sells nearly enough to satisfy me, is Mouse Guard Black Axe, number 4 of 6. This is a long time between issues of this book, but boy, it's worth the wait. What a terrific comic that is. Dave Peterson does such a great job on that. I really highly recommend anybody, if you haven't been reading the Mouse Guard, boy, you really ought to be. It's just terrific stuff. And there's William Shatner, Man of War Ongoing, number 1, but that's from Blue Water, so I'm not convinced that it's going to be worth getting, so we'll have to see on that. Also, I find the Blue Water books very difficult to get. I can never find them in any of the stores, even with William Shatner's name on it.
The only Blue Waters that I've ever tried, really, I've gotten through Comixology, and to be honest, I'm not their biggest fan. The artwork's just so horrible that it's just kind of a jarring experience trying to read one. No matter how good the writer and how good the story, the artwork's just so atrocious. It pulls me out of it. I don't want to read it because the artwork sucks.
Okay, and on that note, we'll call it quits for another week of this week's news and previews. And we'll talk with you guys very soon.
Yes.
And that's it for this episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm actually going to have to take a week off, but I will be back in 2 weeks with the 50th episode of the podcast. I'll have a couple of surprises in store, so be sure to be here. But until then, keep reading your comics.
You'll never win, Joker. I'll always be here to stop you.